Accession number 30493, reel 17.
At what point did you first come into contact with the Americans?
Ah, you mean literally face to face? Yes. Well, now I can tell you specifically, looking here, Solano Valley. Now, the Solano Valley was under observation in the mountains, and it was the end of it was open to observation by the Nazis, and a permanent smoke screen had to be pumped out 24 hours a day, I think, even at night, the screen off the end of this valley. Well, we were suddenly asked to send a not a regiment, but just one battery, and to take over from an American position in that valley. And so we went back up into the mountains again, and there's quite a vivid account in my diary of that journey into this valley. And then suddenly we were in Fifth Army territory, and everything was American around us. And we arrived at the American position in the Solano Valley, and our four guns, I think we had six guns actually, yes. There were four, the Americans on this position had four gun pits already dug. And so we were there while they winched out their guns, and then we winched in ours, and lot of soldiers watched each other's operations with close interest, I remember. And we had to dig an extra two gun pits, which actually was for the first time, this is an indication we were in American territory, we could call up bulldozers to do the digging, which was marvellous, you know, because being a gunner really is nothing but digging holes, trenches, gun pits, real bloody hard work, you know. And to call up a bulldozer in the middle of a war just seemed a miracle for us. And of course, just for two or three days, we were much involved with this American artillery unit. And we ate with them, and we saw the quality of their equipment, which just astounded us, you know. We discovered they got, I think I've talked about this before, haven't I? About their choice, they got four uniforms and half a dozen different pairs of footwear. And just all unbelievable standard of living for an army in the middle of a war. And the food, we just could not believe it. We could not believe the breakfast we had. It was, you know, we hadn't seen a fresh egg. Not for months and months and months. And then suddenly, okay, how'd you like it? Up or over? So we were on the leave camp. That's very memorable. I've certainly never forgotten that confrontation with the Americans, involvement with them. And then later on, I got chatting with the guys who ran the smoke units, and this guy said, "Yeah, gee, we smoked all the way out of Italy," and he gave us figures for the quantities of smoke chemicals and petrol they had to use to pump out this cloud which covered the end of the valley. And they, the typical American guys, I remember that chat very well. It was very quiet, very quiet actually at that front. We just lobbed the odd shell over. But then I got some good photos of the infantry going into action. a long column of GIs suddenly appeared, and they were headed for the front, you know, for the really front line trenches somewhere up in the mountains. And I crouched there at the side of the road and got this silhouette photo of them, which I'm very pleased with. I expected one of them to just turn round, pick up his rifle and blow my head off as a spy or, you know, an intrusive news photographer. It's always a risk I ran, I think, in the battlefield area. But, so there were these occasional meetings and brushings, but armies at war don't really meet very closely, you know. I mean, there we are in an Indian division, and we hardly ever spoke to an Indian. It's shocking, really, the way the army system keeps people apart, really. Except in your own unit, where you become comrades very quickly. So that's it.
How did you find that the British and American and Indian troops got on with each other when they did meet?
Well, it's interesting. One of the sort of again, strangely, my diary makes it clear. I seem to have a sort of plum job that took me out of the routine, and one of them was I had to. I was in the helping the military police in Florence, because when the Nazis left Florence, it was remarkable how there was already an Italian administration in place to take the city over. It's quite extraordinary. It had been ready for months and months. It was there in place. The moment the Nazis left, in came the admin, and began to run the city and rescue it from the desolation that the Nazis left behind. They blew every single bridge over the Arno River, except for the wonderful Ponte Vecchio, the one with the houses sort of built over the arches of the bridge. And the average army man had a very dim view of military policemen, his red caps. It was always the red cap was the enemy, really. You steer clear of them. But as typical in life, if you only get to know people, you rather change your mind about them, you know. And I changed my mind about military policemen. So with them for the week. And we were given a sort of club, I think, and an armband. And we just had to turn up, usually at closing time. I think the deadline was about 11:30. And so we had to be near the drinking dens and whatever, where the guys went for a piss up, you know. And we were told by the military sergeant just to take it easy and don't interfere, just let them go home, you know. And that's how it was. I don't remember. You know, there'd be a mixed. You asked the question about when we mixed together. Well, we seemed to mix together in Florence. I mean, there were. The 8th Army was such an incredibly mixed army. It's really very impressive the way somehow all those soldiers from different parts of the world fought against Hitler in Italy without coming into conflict with each other. I mean, as far as I know, I never witnessed any any internecine conflict, you might say, between the different nationalities involved in fighting Hitler. So we had a cushy time helping the military police. I mean, I think we had 24 hours on, 24 hours off. And 24 hours off meant there were already cinemas and army clubs and the NAFI and ENSA all moved into Florence, and the city was beginning to function again. It's quite remarkable looking back. It's a really remarkable. But of course, it was helped the fact there was an anti-fascist administration in place, and that didn't happen over large areas of Italy, where the AMGOT people, Allied Military Government of Occupied Territories, AMGOT, these people would move in and they look around for somebody to work with, and too often they chose the people who run on the place under Mussolini, and you know they've been fascists really, and these are the easiest people for the AMGOT people to work with. In Florence, it's quite a different matter, and in any town where there was an anti-fascist movement, and often led, of course, by the communists, but there was a united front against the Nazis, and socialists, communists, and liberal-minded Italians all worked together, and that was very evident in Florence. And I mean, we were able to visit the famous gallery and see these art treasures that have been preserved right through. Miraculously, the Nazis didn't plunder everything. I wonder why Gori didn't order all the treasures to be confiscated for his enormous plundered art treasures. He seemed to have been let down by his Nazi commanders in Florence.
When was it you were in Florence?
Sorry?
When was it that you were in Florence?
Yes, I'm not very good at dates. It's there in my diary, but I'd have to fish it out. No, I can't really answer the when without sort of digging around. Not very good on that question.
Where to next, then, afterwards?
Well, now, I think I've got to interrupt here, because this morning I had a sort of, I've made a little note here, this very morning I had a Road to Damascus moment while I was shaving, you see, and it dawned on me that there are five versions of my experience in Italy in my head. Five, not just one or two. Now the first one, obviously, is the questions you put to me awaken memories, but I'm just increasingly doubtful about the value of those memories, frankly. Now the second, the war diaries. Well, they've obviously reading them, and as I am recording them actually at the same time, they're obviously written by a gunner who was with the 8th Army and in the Italian campaign. But they seem to be written by somebody else. That's a strange experience, really strange experience I've gone through. The third, and this is the most reliable, are the photographs. If I have images of that experience in Italy, they're photographic images, because I've often referred to those four albums of 800 odd photos, and I've shown them to friends and relatives through the years. So vivid photographic images of the war in my head, not memories at all, really. It's a vivid visual recall of the war. Now, the fourth thing in my memory, of course, are the books I've read. I've read 100 books, I suppose. Official histories, regimental history, I read academic studies, memoirs of participants, and novels. And they all add up to a sort of knowledge about the war. I mean, the historical facts that I've acquired since the war. Now, they are all in my head too, all sort of mixed up with everything else. Now, the fifth thing I've discovered, dawned on me, very important in recalling the war, are these remarkable films that sprung out of Italy just after the war, I mean, almost before the war had ended. Filmmakers who'd acquired their skills during the Mussolini era and were forced to conform to fascist limitations on their freedom, suddenly they were liberated. And although film was hard to find and everything was against them, they turned out these wonderful films, unforgettable films. I can see them over and over again. And these are films by Rossellini, Visconti, De Sica, Fellini, Rossi, and they just capture the bleakness and the suffering and the political awakening of the Italians during the war and after the war. Paisa, Bicycle Thieves, Rome, Open City. I can see those films over and over again. And I've dug out, look, here we are, I've got it in front of me here. Rome, Open City, Roma, Città Aperta. And Martin Scorsese, you know, one of the greatest of Hollywood filmmakers, he makes really brilliantly observed films. He says, Rome, Open City, for me, the most precious moment of film history. Now, there's a compliment, you see, for film. And it does, it just captures the Italy I remember. This is an important thing. It's all gone forever, that Italy. It exists only in my scribblings in my diary every day and in these films that were made on the spot. All the suffering was in every fresh in everybody's memories. So, there we are, five versions. So no wonder I'm mixed up. You can't answer some questions.
You'd mentioned earlier that the winter of 43, I think it was particularly harsh.
44. Oh, that was a shock. A shocker. And then all the military strategists and all the brass hats and the generals and the politicians, all of them involved in the war, had no, apparently no understanding of what weather can do in a military campaign. Because you just can't imagine the cold, the wind, the rain, the mud. I mean, everything bogged down. There's some vivid images in my diary of how we had to function. Fighting a war, trying to, with the weather just totally against you. I mean, everything heavy just got bogged down. It wasn't just tanks and heavy goods, it was jeeps and our guns were sucked. I've got some photos taken with us perhaps being knee deep in mud and still having to fire. We had to bring the ammunition to the gun. I've never. In fact, there's some passage I've quoted here from, I think it was official history somewhere, where this man is, this historian is perfectly aware that if you base a war on mass artillery, you need masses of shells for it, with vehicles to bring the shells up through the mountains to the guns. And we had to somehow, we had to very often rebuild the bloody roads so that the vehicle could get to us. And then on top of that, when they couldn't get very close, we had to lug these shells. I mean, four of them in a steel box, four 25-pounder shells with the weight of a steel box. That's 100, it's 100 weight. And you had to lug these steel boxes from the trucks to the gun sight. And I can tell you that was bloody hard work. And if you were freezing, wet, you had no dry clothes to get into at night, you really became a rugged soldier, no doubt about it. You became a tough gunner under those conditions. Well, they didn't just end that night. You didn't just go home to a barracks and creep into a warm bed. You crept into your wet, soaking blankets and shivered all night. And then in the middle of the night, there'd be a call to the guns, 4:30 a.m. You had a fire program down. And slopping about in the mud. God, how did we stand it? You know, it's all recalled by the diaries. It's been shut out of my mind for so long. It's really a strange experience, you know.
Was there an issue of specific kit for the colder weather?
Now that's a joke, that is. The army issued with a ground sheet, it was called. It was so designed that you could sling it round your shoulders, and there were just one or two buttons to secure it, and that was your defence against the rain. And the army, that's what the army had. When you look at the equipment armies have today, the soldiers are loaded down with equipment and protective clothing of all kinds. We didn't have any protective clothing. I was very fortunate in, while I was in Italy, in Cyprus rather, I very wisely bought a sheepskin jacket. It didn't have sleeves, if I remember, but it was very neat to wear. It was a sheepskin leather jacket without sleeves, and I could wear it underneath my uniform. And what a godsend that was in Italy in that winter. I really felt quite privileged to be wearing it. I've still got it today. There were no boots. At one time, my boots wore out and the supplies were so bad. I was going around in plimsolls. And it took weeks before, the sole of one of my boots just tore off. It was a real hand-to-mouth existence, I can tell you. It's sad that that campaign is forgotten, you know, and it's one of the toughest campaigns of the war. I'm sure it's the closest we got to what the kind of warfare the Russians had to fight, which was such a horrendous, horrendous war. Physically, it was very demanding. And I'm so glad I was fit at the time. I was really fit, and I survived it. But we all survived one way or another. Marvellous. It just shows how well-trained we were. We were a team. It's the only good thing I've got to say about the army.
Would the gunners have much occasion to see the results of their work?
Ah! My God! Did we? There again, my diary, it shows, I'm very pleased actually to show that this young man of 22, 23, was very concerned about the effects of what he was doing. Okay, we poured thousands of tons of steel out of the barrels of our guns, and we could hear right across the battlefield the other guns, the mediums and the heavies, all blasting away. And then, sometimes the bombing was on such a scale that I talk about the sky being black with American bombers sailing over to bomb different parts of Italy, and going further on, they were bombing Bulgaria and Romania. I described Spitfire and the Desert Air Force, that they were very proud to keep their Middle East label, Desert Air Force, the DAF. You had these Spitfires roaring over us and picking out targets, you know. And you asked me, did we see the results? Yes. Yes, we did. I mean, to think, see Casino after weeks and months of shelling and bombing. We weren't, I mean, I don't think any of our shells were on Casino, but we came up through Casino and saw, there it's in detail in my diary. Just horrifying. I mean, it's extraordinary, you see, I'm having to live through it all again because I don't remember the desolation and misery and death that I saw. It's not in my memory, it's there in my diary. I saw German tanks with the burned bodies hanging out. I have no memory of that, it's there in my diary. Mangled bodies on the battlefield. You know, did I see, did we see the result? Yes, we did, we did. And the desolation, the whole towns, villages, just heaps and heaps of rubble. And the rail yards, they were smashed. Forli, remember Forli rail yards, they'd been bombed and bombed and bombed. And I've got photos of so much of that damage. It's a miracle that towns like Rome and Venice were spared, except on the fringes. I mean, Mestre outside Venice. Venice, it seemed to be untouched, but Mestre, just 20 miles away, was bombed and flattened because it was an interchange supply route. What's very useful is a chronology of the war, which is, I find, very useful. It gives you the tonnage of bombs that were dropped in throughout the war. The chronology of the Second World War, there it is, issued by the Royal Institute of International Affairs. That's very detailed. And there, you know, if you want dates, there it all is. And it gives a tonnage of bombs dropped during the war. Italy in the Mediterranean area, 1942, reaching record intensity on October 24th. Yes, the answer to your question is we did see what this incredible shelling and barrages we were involved in. I mean, 400 shells per gun were brought up in the very last big barrage that was compared with the Alamein barrage, which opened Montgomery's terrific onslaught. He brought in masses of artillery, And then at the end of the war, we fired off 500 rounds per gun. And, that, and there again, it's all in my diary. 500 rounds per gun. And then the barrels of the guns, of the 25-pounders, were practically white-hot. And there, afterwards, well, that was we crossed one, two or three rivers, and the war was over. On these river lines, I came across the makeshift graves, and the Nazi, some Nazi soldier, had buried his comrade in a in a sort of slit trench in the wall of the river, or in the bank of the river. And he scratched, he's still a law Nazi, he scratched the swastika in the mud in the wall of the dugout over his comrade's body. An unrepentant Nazi, defying us right at the very end of the war.